is dealing in fear. Thai police used tear gas, water cannon, and rubber bullets on Sunday as they tried to stop protesters from marching on the office of Prime Minister Prayuth Chan-o-cha, calling for him to resign. More than 1,000 protesters took part in that demonstration. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Finance Minister Rishi Sunak will both self-isolate in line with national guidance, abandoning heavily criticized plans to take part in a pilot scheme that would have allowed them to continue working. The U-turn comes a day after the health minister said he had tested positive for COVID-19 and at a time when the government's coronavirus response is under intense scrutiny. Residents in Venezuela say gangs are taking control of the capital, Caracas. Gang members went through western Caracas's El Cementerio Barrio, telling residents to get out and that shooting would not stop. Barrio residents have been sheltering in place. El Cementerio and five nearby neighborhoods have been paralyzed by an unprecedented display of firepower by gangs known by neighbors as the Boys. Brief clashes erupted on Sunday between Israeli police and Palestinians at Al-Aqsa Mosque, over visits by Jews to the compound revered in Judaism as the site of two destroyed biblical temples. No serious injuries were reported in what police described as stone throwing early in the day by several Palestinian youngsters. Australia's two largest states on Sunday reported slight declines in new COVID-19 infections, prompting authorities to say it could be days before tough lockdown measures showed progress in containing the spread of the Delta variant. Sydney and all of Victoria State are under stay-at-home orders after a flare-up. This is VOA News. Flash floods hit southern Germany on Sunday, killing at least one person, turning roads into rivers, and adding to the flooding devastation that has claimed the lives of more than 180 people across Europe in recent days. A district of Bavaria became the latest region to be hit by record rainfall and floods. And German Chancellor Angela Merkel promised fast financial aid on Sunday after visiting one of the areas worst affected by the record floods that have killed at least 157 people in the country over the past days. Iran insisted on Sunday that a prisoner swap deal has been agreed with the United States. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said this a day after Washington denied such an agreement had been reached. The foreign minister said in a tweet, there is a deal and even an agreement on how to announce it. Turkey on Sunday slammed a ruling by a top European Union court allowing the banning of headscarves under certain conditions as a clear violation of religious freedoms, adding the move would exacerbate prejudices against Muslim women in Europe. The Luxembourg-based EU Court of Justice ruled on Thursday that companies in the bloc can ban employees from wearing a headscarf under certain conditions if they need to do so to protect an image of neutrality to customers. Nigeria has put six states on red alert after seeing a worrisome rise in COVID-19 infections. A government official said, urging people to curb gatherings and hold prayers outside mosques during a Muslim festival this week. Nigeria, Africa's most populous nation, is like most parts of the continent now facing a COVID-19 third wave after detecting the more transmissible Delta variant. Two South African soccer players have become the first athletes inside the Olympic Village to test positive for COVID-19, with the Tokyo Games opening on Friday. Organizers confirmed the positive tests on Sunday, but didn't identify the athletes other than to say they were non-Japanese. The South African Football Association later confirmed there were three COVID-19 cases in its delegation, two players, and a video analyst. Britain is backing 15 new studies into the treatment and diagnosis of long COVID. That's a condition that can include dozens of symptoms and last for months after an initial bout of infection with COVID-19. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman reporting for VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C.
The scientists in Uganda are also developing a homegrown vaccine, and which is factoring in the new variants. So yes, there are efforts within Africa, and we are using a two-pronged approach.
A Ugandan cabinet minister says coronavirus infection cases are dropping in the East African country.
Everything has always a start, and as an organization in exile, it's our duty and responsibility, indeed our rights, to raise all those concerns, and we'll do it, and we do not really have to ask permission to anyone to do what we are doing.
A Rwanda political pressure group is expressing concern about the deployment of Rwandan troops to Mozambique.
There are forces at play that want to create instability for their own political purposes. I think that's what how this thing started after the president's arrest. I think small groups of people in different parts of the country were mobilized to create chaos and havoc.
And Business Unity South Africa, the principal representative of businesses in the country, is expressing concern about the unrest that has left more than 100 dead. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Uganda, the recently imposed 42 lockdown is proving effective in sharply reducing coronavirus infections in the East African country. According to Dr. Chris Bariumunsi, an epidemiologist, public health expert, and Minister for ICT and National Guidance, other medical measures have also helped to reduce hospitalizations of COVID patients. Addressing how the pandemic has affected Africa, Dr. Bariumunsi, who is also a leading member of Uganda's COVID-19 task force, says limited access to the vaccine has undermined efforts by respective African governments to combat waves of the virus. He also says plans by the European Union to implement vaccine passports is unfortunate and regrettable. The measure will not recognize COVID, the AstraZeneca vaccine produced in India, which is widely being used across Africa, including Uganda. To learn more about efforts by Ugandan authorities to combat the recent wave of coronavirus cases, I reach ICT Minister and Public Health Expert, Dr. Chris Bariumunsi.
We recorded the first case of COVID-19 in March 2020. But shortly before we recorded that first case, the President of Uganda, Yoweri Museveni, announced a string of measures. And I can say Ugandans religiously observed the measures to the extent that, yes, we had a wave, but what had been predicted by the scientists are the number of cases which would be registered and the deaths. Because of the enforcement and observance of the measures, we didn't reach those high figures. At the beginning of this year, we even began recording zero cases of those who were testing for COVID, and I can say we mounted a very strong response against COVID, and Uganda did fairly well.
The government, as part of the effort to limit the spread, imposed a 42-day lockdown.
Oh,
some
yes.
People are saying the government did well with distribution of cash and all that, but some people are also worried that PPEs are not available for doctors to really care for patients, and that some people are even being held for non-payment of hospital bills because of the ailment. How is the government really dealing with some of these things to address them appropriately for Ugandans?
The president, on behalf of government, announced a lockdown for 42 days and the other public health prevention measures. That we are now 3 weeks plus in the lockdown, and the figures which we are now seeing a drop in the infection rates. For instance, at the beginning of the lockdown, our positivity rates were about 18%, meaning out of 100 people whom were testing, 18 would test positive. But this has dropped 10% as of today, and we are pushing harder to drop it to 5 or even less. And also, the number of cases being hospitalized has also started reducing. We now actually have 3 hospital beds, contrary to what we saw in June. So therefore, there is a great improvement since the lockdown came. So what we are reporting was mainly what was observed around June, beginning of July, when the lockdown was starting, but things have since improved.
AstraZeneca vaccine is being used by Uganda mostly, and across Africa, the vaccine produced in India. Now, yes. There are concerns that the European Union is proposing vaccine passport scheme that will not recognize that. How will Uganda in particular address this or engage the European Union to address this concern?
The reason why we are using AstraZeneca is that we are satisfied that it is as safe as other vaccines. We are satisfied that it is as efficacious as other vaccines, but above all, it is cheap when you compare it with the other vaccines. And also, compared with the other vaccines like Pfizer, the refrigeration facilities are suitable in our conditions here in Africa, whereas Pfizer requires supercooling refrigeration, which we don't have in our systems. We find AstraZeneca much more suitable. So I think the European Union should not punish African countries and the developing world.
Is there any effort in Africa, particularly in Uganda, to produce vaccines on the continent so you'll be able to vaccinate your people?
Well, yes, at the continental level, the African governments are engaging through the World Trade Organization to facilitate a process where we can have industries here in Africa so that we can create hubs, maybe in West Africa, East Africa, Southern Africa, Central Africa, to have manufacturing plants for these vaccines. So the negotiation is there, facilitated by African Union and our political leaders. In Uganda, we have also taken proactive steps. About 1 week ago, the president was commissioning the starting of a construction of a manufacturing plant for the vaccines. The scientists in Uganda are also developing a homegrown vaccine, and which is factoring in the new variants. So yes, there are efforts within Africa, and we are using a two-pronged approach.
Dr. Chris Bariomunsi is Uganda's ICT minister and a leading member of COVID-19 task force. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The Rwandan National Congress, or RNC, a political pressure group, is expressing concern about the recent deployment of Rwandan troops to Mozambique. The Rwandan contingent, which includes military personnel and police, have been deployed to Cabo Delgado, a province battling growing insecurity and terrorism. This comes after the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, recently announced plans to deploy troops in Mozambique. Rwanda says its contingent will work closely with both Mozambican state forces as well as troops from the SADC regional bloc. But the RNC says the presence of Rwandan troops in Mozambique will become a destabilizing force in the Southern African country. It also expresses concern that the deployment is a ploy to target Rwandan refugees in the Southern African region who have become critics of the administration in Kigali. Dr. Etienne Mutabazi is the spokesperson for the Rwandan National Congress, or RNC. He tells me that it is prudent for Mozambique to explain the agreement which enabled authorities in Kigali to deploy the Rwandan troops.
Because of some precedents, including the assassinations that took place in South Africa and elsewhere in Southern Africa, including Mozambique and Malawi, have a cases. If you need the name, we can go into those. Abduction, disappearance. That's why we are alarmed that this force, when it is deployed, its mission is not necessarily humanitarian. It has those implications. Among us, we have rooted in our press.
Are you therefore saying that the deployment of Rwandan troops to Mozambique will lead to assassination of Rwandan refugees in Mozambique? That's the main reason why Rwanda deployed troops to that country to fight terrorism?
It's not the main reason, but it may be a cover, because they will come in a certain official capacity, though we are not saying that they are not necessarily there for the purpose they have expressed to the public. You have other information. They are just as guards for imperialism, special for the Total Company, and they are paid by France. That we know, Rwanda is not in a position to pay such a deployment outside of its borders. But we, having regard to what happened before, we are saying this can be a conduit, a channel to continue those action of targeting refugees. And General James Kabarebe, the special security advisor to President Kagame, has expressed it quite well, saying that the government is doing whatever it can to disturb refugees, especially in Southern Africa.
Your organization is calling on the government in Maputo to explain the bilateral relations it signed with the administration in Kigali, for which reason it enabled the Rwandan government to send troops to Mozambique. Why that?
It is a legitimate exercise between the two sovereign states. Then it should transpire in the public, because the question is why. Is Mozambique overstepping the South African Development Community arrangement as far as the deployment in Cabo Delgado is concerned, and went to call on especially President Kagame, not the government of Rwanda as such, because we know that at the end of April, President Felipe Nyusi threw to Kigali and met with Kagame. They should make those arrangements public if there's no sinister agenda behind.
Well, I think it's the responsibility of a government to protect its people, because that is its core duty. Some people say that why should they explain itself to a third party when the administration in Maputo is doing what it can within its constitutional powers to protect its people with the help from a friendly African country like Rwanda?
Access to information is a human right, and I am sure as a journalist you are very well aware of that. And this, we found it in many international instruments, including the African Charter on Human People's Rights and many UN instruments. So there's nothing quite new in what we are asking. And we are concerned as well, because we are Rwandese, we need to know about it. Why is that country, particular country, getting involved into another region, while it has even failed to restore law and order and even mutual relation in the East African community, which is in the neighborhood? That's why we ask all those questions.
What is your organization going to do if the administration in Maputo refuses to adhere or answer any of the questions? What would you have achieved?
This is a process, and the mere fact we are talking about this is that we have at least done something. We will continue to do the same until our voice is heard. Everything has always a start, and as an organization in exile, it's our duty and responsibility, indeed our rights, to raise all those concerns, and we'll do it. And we do not really have to ask permission to anyone to do what we are doing.
Dr. Etienne Mutabazi is the spokesperson for the Rwandan National Congress, or RNC. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Business Unity South Africa, the principal representative of businesses in the country, is expressing concern about the latest unrest that has left more than 100 dead, many more injured, and destroyed property. The group says the unrest will undermine investor confidence. It also says it is not satisfied with the government's reaction to the unrest. It says a quicker response could have prevented deaths as well as stopped the looting and torching of businesses. This after President Cyril Ramaphosa admitted the government should have acted sooner. He says the masterminds of the unrest are being investigated. The violence was instigated by the incarceration of former President Jacob Zuma. The former president has handed himself over to authorities to begin a 15-month jail sentence imposed by the Constitutional Court for contempt. He had refused to give evidence to an anti-graft inquiry into allegations of corruption while he was president. Cass Kavodia is the CEO of Business Unity South Africa. He tells me that it is important for President Ramaphosa to continue to ensure the security services act firmly and professionally against those he described as anarchists to serve as a deterrent.
We've expressed a concern to the president as well. Obviously, our members' businesses are extremely concerned, not just with what they've lost, but with the ability or inability of government to protect assets going forward in the next few days and to curtail the sort of action. We met with the economic cluster ministers last night to try and plan some sort of collaborative effort to give them information and intelligence that we get from our members and to see if together we can't identify critical assets that must be protected. We can't get military to escort trucks to deliver critical goods. So, you know, oxygen needs to be delivered to different parts of the country. That's critical. Chlorine needs to be delivered for water purification purposes. That's critical. We continue to put pressure on government to ensure that both military and police are deployed quickly and they act swiftly and they protect those economic assets and property that have not been attacked yet.
The president addressed the nation, also expressing concern, urging people not to go on rampage and attack businesses and all that. Yeah. Are you pleased with the response of the government, particularly when you called or pressured the administration to deploy military? Are your members pleased with the response of the president and his government so far?
No, not entirely, to be quite honest. We believe that the government should have acted much sooner than they did. We believe that its intelligence agency should have picked up that after the incarceration of ex-President Zuma, there were murmurings of potential actions by his supporters, which I think started this, but it's no longer that. It spread to looting and thuggery now. So I think they should have acted sooner. Even in releasing the military, they released 2,500 troops. They must release more than that.
Because a political analyst was saying that the pent-up feeling of the lockdown and the economic disparity between the widening those who have and have not was a recipe for this to happen, and that even without the incarceration of Zuma, something like that was bound to happen due to the massive economic disparity between the haves, those who are very rich, and the poverty-stricken people in South Africa. Do you think his analysis is justified?
His assertion about the massive economic disparities and so on is absolutely correct. I mean, we're one of the most unequal societies in the world. We have significant social and economic problems. And these need to be dealt with, and I mean government and labor and business and others are we engaging all the time, and we're still engaging to see what we do about a more inclusive economy and so on. Business did in July last year present to government a detailed post-COVID economic recovery strategy that talked to how we can build a more inclusive economy and so on. But we need to create the environment for that. We need to create the environment for investment and growth. And we certainly as business don't believe we're doing that adequately. Would this have happened? I think that, look, I'm absolutely clear personally that there are forces at play that want to create instability for their own political purposes. I think that's how this thing started after the president's arrest. I think small groups of people in different parts of the country were mobilized to create chaos and havoc. And then once they started breaking down and they started destroying property, then and ordinary people saw that there's an opportunity for them and hungry people as well, poor people to get food. I'm sure there are elements of that in there. But when you see people loading up TVs into a Mercedes and driving away, you can't convince me those are poor people.
Cass Kavodia is the CEO of Business Unity South Africa. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. In Zambia, civil society groups are expressing concern that new accreditation requirements from the Electoral Commission of Zambia will undermine their efforts to monitor the August 12 general election. The groups represented by ActionAid Zambia include the Foundation for Democratic Process, or FODEP, and the GIES Initiative. They say the new guidelines, which include bulky paperwork, red tape, and payment, are expensive and laborious. To be accredited, a poll monitoring group must submit a certified copy of its national registration card and three copies of the Declaration of Compliance. It also requires any group to provide proof of prior work it has undertaken regarding governance over the last 3 years. Supporters say the new guidelines will ensure only credible observers with a track record will be accredited for the polls. For more reaction about the Electoral Commission's new rules, I reach Nalucha Ziba, ActionAid Zambia's country director.
The Electoral Commission of Zambia recently has issued an election monitor and observer accreditation notice and standard operating procedures, which aims at limiting the number of observers and monitors to be accredited per organization in all constituencies, largely attributed to the COVID situation in the country. These have placed a civil society organization in a precarious positions, as some of the measures which have been introduced are demanding that local observer monitors need to provide proof of registration, of incorporation, indicating that the organization has been in existence for the past 3 years and evidence of having worked in the governance sector for the past 3 years. So these are some of the measures that we notice that might affect the quality and participation of local civil society in election observation this year, as it has also brought on board extra costs, such as the need to fill in a form and also get certification in terms of commissioning of oath, more especially for local civil society operating in rural areas where some of these services are not available.
But some analysts are saying that the new requirements are necessary to ensure only credible civil society organizations with track record are allowed to monitor the elections. What do you say to that?
Unfortunately, the measures put in place do not promote transparency and accountability. For instance, ECZ has limited the number of local monitors to be allowed at any time per organization to access some facilities to only one. So if you are only allowing one person to monitor an election, how do you call that to be transparent and necessary, as opposed to the principles that of promoting democracy and fairness, equality and equity? Therefore, we are of the views that the guidelines that ECZ had issued are aimed at gagging. For instance, we have noticed that over the years, we have seen an increase in social movements in Zambia who are working in the area of governance, largely due to the deteriorating situation of the governance situation in the country. So when you look at these measures, it can be argued that they are aimed at limiting such organizations and institutions at the end of the day, because most of the institutions that will be able to meet these criteria which are being set are largely NGOs and larger national NGOs that are well-resourced.
What do you say to the analysts who are suggesting that perhaps if some of these conditions are too difficult for the CSOs, they should bind together, come under one umbrella, and share the responsibilities and cost associated with the requirement and spread themselves across the country and do the same thing as monitoring the elections to ensure transparency, credibility, and accountability during the election process?
Well, currently, most civil society are working as in consortiums. However, that does not reduce the cost. In the past, when you were accrediting monitors from civil society organization, what was happening was you just take a list with names and you attach natural registration cards to that, and the organization, one organization in the consortium, will take up the process of accrediting others. But however, now what has changed is that for each of the accreditors, there's a form to be filled in, And then there is need for also for those registrations to be certified by a commission of oath. And when you're doing certification in Zambia, most of it has to be done by somebody with legal and so on. And when you look at the spread of services for commissioning of oath, they do not exist in most of the rural parts of the country. And that's where most of these challenges are being posed and they are coming from. Therefore, if we wanted monitors to be equitably distributed, covering all the 10 provinces and the wards in this country, there was need to also look at the spread of the services that will go with the accreditation process.
Are you engaging or will they be engaging the Electoral Commission to rescind its decision on these new laid down regulations?
We will be engaging the Electoral Commission of Zambia considering the broader challenges that the new regulations are imposing, more especially transport, which we have seen in rural areas where monitors to go for accreditation, in some instances, they might have to cover over 10, 15 kilometers and back. Also, the funds, the local civil society has to source extra to cover those transport costs in terms of budgeting, which was not there before.
Nalu Chaziba is ActionAid Zambia's country director. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impunga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, in Eswatini, an umbrella group of parties, the Political Party Assembly, or PPA, says it is undeterred in its effort to demand democracy in the Southern African country. This, despite what the group says are attempts by authorities to weaken popular demand for pragmatic democratic reforms to enable citizens to elect their leaders. Their remarks come after King Nswati III appointed Cleopas Dlamini, CEO of the Kingdom's Public Service Pension Fund, as the new prime minister. The appointment follows what the king described as a dialogue with his subjects. The dialogue was aimed at discussing demands by protesters for democracy. Violent demonstrations have left at least 27 dead and incurred the loss of about 5,000 jobs and destroyed property. Meanwhile, a fact-finding mission from the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, is in Eswatini to meet all stakeholders as part of a regional effort to ease political tensions. But the PPA said it lacks confidence in the fact-finding mission. Mbogesini Shabangu is a leading member of the PPA and the general secretary of the opposition Swaziland Democratic Party, or SWADEPA. He tells me that members of the PPA will continue to pressure the new prime minister and the government to implement actual democracy as practiced around the world.
Firstly, Peter, he's been wrongly appointed. He should be appointed from the August House. Unfortunately, the guy that has been appointed is not from the August House. He's from the Senate House. So that's one wrong. We think it's deliberate, and we don't know the reason for deliberately flouting the Constitution. That's number one. Any hope for anything better from him, we don't expect anything. Here to serve the appointing authority.
But some people are suggesting that his appointment could help address some of the concerns the PPA, civil society organizations, are talking about in terms of having more democratic reforms.
He doesn't have those characteristics. One, he doesn't have the powers to do that. All powers of control of the government of Eswatini, judiciary, executive, legislature, are vested on the king. Simple.
But since the king is an absolute monarch, doesn't that mean that he has the power to choose who the prime minister should be?
He has, but he uses those powers to appoint somebody that will serve him, his interest and his personal interest, and that's it.
Does that mean that the PPA and other civil society organizations are not going to work with the new prime minister?
Oh, the only way we're going to work with him is demand our rights of having the power being brought to the people to govern themselves. That's the working relationship we're going to have with him.
Some Swazis, I understand, are displeased that despite the fact that the SADC fact-finding mission is in the country to meet all stakeholders, they are yet to meet political parties.
Is this the situation on the ground?
For your information, the Eswatini government is part and parcel of the facilitation of who will be met. So we know very well they will not be eager for the team to meet political parties. They'll do whatever possible to make sure they don't meet political parties.
But the last time they met you, the political party assembly, and Botswana president who heads the organ says that the fact-finding mission will consult widely with all stakeholders in the kingdom before departing Eswatini on June 22. How do you respond to that?
Even the last time, Peter, we were not invited. We were crushed. So for your information, even the last time, we were not invited. We got crushed. So we don't expect, even this time around, to get any formal prior notification and invitation.
Does that mean that because the Constitution does not necessarily allow for the participation of political parties in elections, the reason why the PPA is not even being considered to meet officials of the fact-finding mission from SADC?
But how do you not involve or include political parties when you have Article 25 that gives people the freedom to associate an assembly, which means formation of political parties? Because the only thing where political parties are bad form is in the governing structures and the electoral process.
So what's the latest development on the ground as the PPA, following protests by pro-democracy activists that coincided with the dialogue that the king had recently with all subjects in the kingdom?
The king did not have any dialogue with anyone, Peter. It was a monologue. He called people, and he was the only one talking, and that was the end of the story. My dictionary doesn't call that a dialogue. That's why pro-democracy movements and political parties will continue to protest and demand for power to be back to the people.
Mbogisini Shabangu is a leading member of the PPA and the general secretary of the opposition Swaziland Democratic Party, or SWADEPA. He spoke with me from the Swatini capital, Mbabane. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpunga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Egyptian giants Al Ahly beat Kaizer Chiefs 3-0 in Morocco on Saturday to become the first side in history to be crowned African champions 10 times. Goals from Mohamed Sharif, Magde Afsa, and Mohamed El Salouia handed Ahly the title, with the Chiefs having to play the whole of the second half with 10 men after Hape Moshiane was sent off right at the stroke of halftime. Ahly's record of 10 times champion is now double that of their nearest challengers, with city rivals Zamalek and DR Congo's TP Mazembe both tied on 5 each. Another milestone was that of Al Ahly coach, South Africa's Pisto Mosimane, who has now overseen 3 Champions League victories. He helped the Egyptians defend the title they won with him as coach last year, in addition to his triumph with South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns in 2016. On Saturday, he beat a team, Kaizer Chiefs, that he supported as a boy. Meanwhile, Africa is backing the staging of the World Cup every 2 years, though it already hosts the Africa Cup of Nations every 2 years. Confederation of African Football President Patrice Motsepe reportedly says his organization firmly backs the proposal put forward by Saudi Arabia at last month's FIFA Congress. Motsepe was speaking after Friday's CAF Executive Committee meeting in Morocco, citing serious financial challenges, a lack of infrastructure and facilities. The CAF president said African football could probably be the biggest beneficiary of a World Cup every 2 years. He said Africa's hope is that any boost in revenue would ultimately filter down its member associations, which could then use the funds to develop the sport. However, Motsepe didn't explain how Africa would be able to accommodate both a World Cup and Nations Cup and their qualifying campaigns every other year. At present, the finals are played in alternative years
After CAF moved the Nations Cup from even to odd years in 2013 in order to avoid staging the competition in the same year as the World Cup. Africa's top teams have a busy 2022, starting with the coronavirus-delayed Nations Cup in Cameroon from January to February and ending the year in November and December at the World Cup in Qatar. Meanwhile, the Olympics, Tokyo 2020, kick off this week. The opening ceremony is at 8 p.m. Tokyo time on July 23rd, but the baseball, softball, and football competitions begin on Wednesday, July 21st. The first gold medal is expected to be awarded in the women's 10-meter air rifle on Saturday, July 24th, with the cycling road races following later that day. The athletics events begin on Friday, July 30th, with 10 days of action culminating with the men's marathon, which ends on the final day in Tokyo on Sunday, August 8th. The women's 100-meter final is on Saturday, July 31st, and the men's follow on Sunday, August 1st. The swimming events run from Saturday, July 24th to Sunday, August 1st. The closing ceremony begins at 8 p.m. Tokyo time on Sunday, August 8th. And that's it for this edition of Netherlands Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. A few weeks ago, I gave high marks to the Southern African Regional Organization, SADC, for its decision to dispatch its standby peacekeeping force to northern Mozambique to assist the government in its confrontation with rebel forces. I also noted that quite significantly and remarkably, SADC decided that it would pay the full cost of the operation. The next step was for SADC on the 7th of July to inform the Secretary General of the United Nations that it had decided to send its forces to northern Mozambique. This is in compliance with the Charter, specifically Chapter 8 of the Charter, which regulates the relationship between the United Nations and regional organizations. It was not to seek permission of the Security Council to proceed with the operation. The letter to the Secretary General also observed that SADC would welcome other participation of African groups outside the southern region, but that participation should be coordinated with the African Union. So it was a surprise that shortly afterwards, the government of Rwanda announced that it was sending military forces to northern Mozambique without coordination with SADC. Many members of SADC were quite surprised by that move, and opposition party in Mozambique specifically objected to the participation of Rwanda in any operation in Mozambique. There has been many speculation as to what had happened. Some have suggested that the foreign investors that have invested heavily in northern Mozambique perhaps were not satisfied with the capability of SADC peacekeeping forces in Mozambique and may have sought other arrangements, and that may have produced the dispatch of Rwanda's military force to the north. I must say, in agreement with the president of Mozambique. But even if this is true, that is the wrong way to go about it. What we do have here, once again, a teaching moment. Again and again, we have seen that when independent African states and institutions have taken initiatives in terms of the maintenance of peace and security, they are either faced with attempts to control what they want to do or to be pushed aside. There have been some very classic examples. The best one was, of course, the question of Libya. Before Gaddafi was killed and removed from office, the African Union produced a very good roadmap for Libya. But that roadmap was pushed aside in favor of a plan by the League of Arab States. And from then on, the African states lost full control. But we do see today the consequences of pushing aside the African organizations. What we do see, disaster and disaster, and now control has been assumed mainly by non-African states. We also notice what happened in Mali. When the Mali issue arose years ago, the West African organization put together a peacekeeping force, and they made the mistake of going to the Security Council to seek for finance and logistics. And they were told politely that ECOWAS is not yet ready for big time play. And while they were waiting, France intervened unilaterally, only later to bring in the United Nations. Recently, there were attempts also to prevent the African Union from participating in negotiations with respect to the Grand Renaissance Dam in Ethiopia. But fairly, the Security Council, in a understanding last week, said that the African Union should have the primary, though not the exclusive, authority to deal with the matter. So these are issues which Africans should bear in mind and not to give up. It is understandable that it might be discouraging, but they have to press on, because if they do not press on, Africa will find itself always standing outside the major decisions that affect the lives of its people. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Next level music.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Say you got me, but I know so you delight with the look in your eyes. Stop acting funny. Say you know they pick my call, I don't call you 10 times. Yeah, I love you. Even when I don't say you delight, no. Yeah, I miss you. Even when I don't say you they run, no. Who's your name because of Jennifer? Now she they do the daddy that the Jennifer.
Calm down, I don't feel good when I see my baby crying. And I got love for you, believe me, I mean it, I don't wanna lie. You talk about Jennifer, she the daughter of my aunt called Monica. Nothing going on, she's my sister. I'm not a terrorist, I'm the America. Hey, hey, hey. Niki lala no masimu si so yele, una cheze moto. Kuna message zao na video zao, moyo utaupa joto. Unanifuata nyuma nyuma tati nitembe, yani gila chocho. Mwisho uje nifuma kwao, nikifanya nao, yasti gongola mbo.
Oh, I'm looking.
crying. Girl, you know that I'm your daddy. My coco coco be like that. Come on, summer, give me your magic. Oh,
tear out. Coming at me like the baddest tear out like a cop.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a masquerade does not perform to an outside audience until he performs well at the home base. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.